Okay, welcome everyone for the English medium discussion. Good participation today. So before going to the appointed topic, traditional topic, if anyone is having specific question or statements or any kind of presentation towards a discussion, we can take few minutes, and if there is no such, we will go to the traditional discussion.
Sri Bante.
Yes.
We have received one report. With your permission, I would like to present that report, Bhante.
Yeah, we can start with that. Please present it.
Yes, Bhante. Dear Bhante, I am 15 years old and I have been practicing for 3 years. This is my experience. Please advise me. Today, I practice mindful sleeping. I lay down and when I close my eyes, I could easily focus on my breath as I was very comfortable. However, after a while in silence, I found myself wanting to dream. I focused my awareness on the desire. Initially, it was difficult to not indulge in the want. However, the more I watched it, the further my awareness seems to get from it. My awareness became detached from the thought and I would watch it as if it was physically in front of my awareness. My awareness was then on nothing and it was just there. I stayed in this just being state until my awareness shifted to the feeling of sleepiness. Therwan Saranai Hasini. That's the end of the report, Bhante.
Interesting. Being 15 years old and checking your superficial mind as well as the subconscious or dream world or half dreams. So this is the best way for you to understand meditation whenever mind is drifting from mindfulness, when it's daydreaming, fantasizing, how quickly you can bring it back to the primary object. That is called resilience. And that is a very advanced way of practicing, whereby mindfulness is often attacked by unmindfulness, daydreaming, fantasizing, bewilderment. So when such a thing happens, how quickly, how swiftly, how invariably, how in an autopiloting mode, it comes to the primary object. Soon you come, if you are successful, you can see, I was there in a sound, I was entertaining it, or I was hating it, and then all of a sudden, I remember I am not mindful. Soon I came to know that I am not mindful. The mind came back to the primary object. Sometimes with effort, sometimes without effort, sometimes with difficulties, sometimes without difficulties. The Buddha says that in the Sotanu Dhatta Sutta, Danda Bhikkave Upajati Satupado. With all difficulties, the mind came back to the mindfulness. And that can happen even in the deathbed. You comes to know, about to sleep, like about to die, you comes to know something going to happen, and it is happening in the camouflage. It is happening like a magical show. So, but you have to be very thin slicing of time and be aware, and then you see half dreams. Some thoughts with awareness, and thoughts are inert or irrelevant. And after that, you come to know, yes, I know I am not sleeping. The thoughts are happening. And the body also sometimes comfortable, sometimes not comfortable. And then whether its mind goes to the unawareness with your will or not is unexpected thing according to the Chullavedala Sutta. By practicing, naturally you give consent to the unawareness. That consent also without much involvement of ego. Just like going to Sanya Vedaita Nirodha. So that must be so much familiarized, then only you can understand going into sleep, going to death. Or this training is called epistemological training, just like suicidal training. You are trying to die yourself philosophically. So at 15 years old, your parents will not be happy to learn that you are practicing this kind of a thing. They want you, they wanted, they may need you to be long life. But for what is for this life? If you have the knowledge, living is good, long life also good. But if you are living just for the, just like a, how do you call, amygdala, or the reptilian life, or a beastly life, no use. So to understand, you have to understand sleeping, going to sleep and coming back to the sleep. The coming back from the wandering mind to the mindfulness is a awakening part. Now we are talking about the going into sleep-like part. So that often it has been well explained in the mesmerism, in hypnotism. It says you can understand. If you know, you will not be mesmerized because your willpower is very strong. You cannot be asleep. Exactly the same thing, if you are going to experiment with your sleep will not come. You have to drift. That's why people used to take some drugs. Otherwise, if you are going to consider, if you are going to be aware of the half sleep, again you may be more tendency to come back awakeness. But after fighting a little bit, again you will fall into sleep. So it's a kind of a divine thing for a practitioner, a hellish thing for other people. So it's a very nice, and we don't have enough literature according to my understanding, but these mesmerism and how do you call, if I am correct, that Sigmund Freud's follower, he told, this is the way you are digging a tunnel from the consciousness to unconscious, from the superficial mind to in Sinhala we call Yatihita, the subsurface mind. Carl Jung was explaining, but later he was not happy with the Sigmund Freud. But at the beginning they were parallel. And that is the way people addicted into marijuana. That's the way they addicted into tobacco and other kind of thing, because they wanted to do experimenting. But this is no any chemical. This is utter, pure restraint. So therefore, Venerable Jnanarama, if you are going to report about that, often I fall into sleep in sitting, he would say, go prepared. That can happen. Do it in a thin slicing of time. How it is happening? Upanita Sayadaw says, even if it is going out, before going, if you are mindful, after coming back, if you are mindful, in between, no defilements. He gives a certificate. That's a very, very pragmatic. How to purify the being. Before going to the drift or dreaming, if you are mindful, and after coming that also, if you can establish the mindfulness, the resilience, in between, no defilements. So that you can verify. So therefore, please try. Same thing, not only go into sleep, but as Krishnamurti used to say, soon you wake up, be aware. 1 minute, one thought moment before, yourself was not there. And after the awakening, when the five senses come into being, myself, being, put the head into the left side or right side or western side or eastern side, everything matters. So that is the way you are incorporating mindfulness into sleep, mindfulness into day-to-day activities. This is a very interesting thing because this is an utterly private time. You cannot go into sleep with socialization. So therefore, use, and most important thing is that you are sharing with us. We appreciate. Good luck. Yeah.
That's all, Bhante, we have received.
We have some comments, a question, yes.
Pastor Rai Bhante, I just wanted to ask what is the name of the sutta that we're on currently, like the, I guess the specific sutta that we're on, like the I guess the name of it.
Just now I mentioned. The discussion, what we are going to do.
Yeah.
Mahavyuha Sutta.
Mahavyuha Sutta.
Earlier we was doing Chula Vyuha. Okay. And now she had a deport. How do you call it? The English translation?
Okay. Well, it's called the, like the greater Sutta on deployment.
Deployment.
Deployment of battles.
I was not aware. I knew employment, but I with that help, I understood, try to understand deploy. Otherwise, I am not familiar with the English names of the sutta. Mahavyuha, Chulavyuha. This is Mahavyuha Sutta. Okay, we are going to the Mahavyuha Sutta, found in Sutta Nipata, Attakavagga Sutta Nipata.
Okay, so I'll just remind people of the main question that the Buddha is posing here. Again, this is a dialogue between the psychic Buddha and the Buddha. So the psychic Buddha asks the Buddha, those who are settled in views who dispute, saying, this alone is true, do all of them receive only blame, or do some there also win praise? So this is the main question, and to answer this, the Buddha goes into a very long set of answers, and so he says, those who take behavior as supreme speak of purity through self-control. Having taken up an observance, they settle on it, thinking, let's train right here, then there would be purity. Claiming to be skilled, they are led back into existence. If he has fallen away from good behavior and observances, he trembles because he has failed in his action. He longs and yearns for purity here, like one on a road, on a journey, who has lost his caravan. But having abandoned all good behavior and observances, and these deeds blameworthy and blameless, not yearning for either purity or impurity, one should live detached, not grasping peace. So again, as I see it, this main argument is around, like for instance, from my perception, like even if you have a view that's a correct view, but you don't know it's a correct view, you're just practicing it, is it true? And so this kind of mentality we run into a lot around good behavior. So the Buddha is correctly pointing out, like, that we shouldn't be making a religion out of good behavior and so-called purity of action and purity of self-control. And in fact, as he presents, the enlightened are able to put aside this kind of holding on to good behavior and observances, because in the act of holding on, it is a good thing to have good behavior. We should do good. We should avoid evil. But the emphasis that the arahants come to is on purification of the mind, that they cultivate the mind, and they don't put this zealotic emphasis on purification by observances and rituals or behaviors as foremost. So when we read about the description of the Sotapanna, they have overcome. They don't hold on to false rituals, they don't hold on to false purifications. And at the time of the Buddha, or preceding the Buddha, you know, Brahmanism had cultivated a religion that was really based on purification. And at the center of the whole life were purification methods and techniques. For instance, before the time of the Buddha, there was a very large civilization in an area near modern Pakistan. And they had at the center of their town like a large pond, and they would bath in this pond in a ritualistic way. And for sure, there's a lot of benefits to cleaning oneself. Like you'll have less sickness and disease, generally speaking, if you wash and clean your hands, and you have a purification that's built into your society. If you have hygiene built into your society, if you have hygiene around food, hygiene around your bodily, and if that hygiene happens to be a good hygiene, it's a good thing. It'll bring a lot of less disease. And if you're living in an urban environment, if you have millions of people living together in a city, then this cleanliness of the city matters tremendously. If we read descriptions of ancient cities, you know, they would smell from a distance, and the people who lived in the cities were smaller than the people who lived out in the country. If they didn't have good utilities, or they didn't have a good infrastructure for water and pipes and excrement. But when we make purification the be-all and the end-all, this isn't the way it works with arahants. He says that, but having abandoned all good behavior and observances and these deeds blameworthy and blameless, not yearning for either purity or impurity, one should live detached, not grasping peace. And that's because sila is a support to the holy life, but it isn't the end of the holy life. It is a means, but it is not the purpose, and it is not the maturing of wisdom. And we shouldn't get confused between these things. We shouldn't make it an end in itself. But however, most people get caught up in these observances, and it becomes almost like maybe a habit. On the one hand, it can become like an identification between groups of people, that they recognize each other by their outward observances and practices, or it can be like I know that sometimes people can really put a tremendous emphasis or value on somebody who's practicing sort of, it looks like a sila, it looks like some sort of special practices, and you know, they're particularly rigorous about it, and it can be not so helpful. On the other hand, like I've met people, lay people who practice sila, like they practiced not just five precepts, but they may be practicing 10 precepts in their daily life. I knew of somebody in Burma who did 10 precepts in daily life, even though he was looking after his parents who were elderly. So this meant not carrying money, and because he couldn't carry money, he had to walk everywhere. He couldn't take public transport. He couldn't take a bus. And, I'm not sure that, I think he was well admired by his friends, and they would try to help him out. Later on, when his parents passed on, he ordained. And I believe that that person has quite a high level of discipline over themselves, so they might be able to enjoy the holy life. But generally speaking, when I meet monks who have, like I would say, extreme practices, like where they practice all the dutangas, and you know, they're extreme in their practice around each of the rules, then I wonder what that is about, and I find that kind of approach personally to be an impediment. So when I see this kind of idea of abandoning all good behavior and observances, and these deeds blameworthy and blameless, not yearning for either purity or impurity, one lives detached, not grasping peace. This is a great relief to somebody like me, where I believe that one should be very meaningful and purposeful in how one approaches the vinaya. One should use it as a tool and be very discerning and thoughtful in how one practices the vinaya, not like a blind hammer and taking everything to the extreme, taking it to the max, and being like a sort of a champion, or in another level, kind of like a bully, saying, well, I do this practice more intensively than you do, or you're inferior to me because you don't practice this way. And again, you'll see this kind of contempt coming through where they're contemptuous. Oh, you know, you white people, you don't know how to practice properly, or you're not like us, and you don't know how to do this, and you don't know how to do that, and you can't possibly do this and that. And it becomes very like a bullying and a superiority and a contempt. And like you can see in the conservative nature of the mind that one is withdrawing and pulling back and pulling away, you know, from the world. But it's not in a healthy way that it's withdrawing. It's not a secluded way. It's an avoidant way. And it starts to view all impurities or as a contempt, as a disgust. And that disgust around impurity, something that is genuinely dirty or infectious or something like that, is a healthy disgust. But there's another disgust where one is disgusted with just disgusted with people who are different, you know. And you know, so this will get mixed up with contempt and with superiority. So like, I am superior to you and you are inferior to me, whereas the reality is that we're all different. So if you fail to be at peace with people who are different, and you expect everybody to be, oh, like me, and those people who are not like me, we avoid, it gets very, very mixed up into this levels of contempt, disgust, and it brings the worst out of the religion and out of the politics and out of life. And it creates enemies, and it is very divisive. Whereas the Arahant is frictionless, moving through the world and sees everybody as individual and not as inferior or not as superior or not as the same. And this is the heart of, you know, where we have good practices like washing our hands before we eat and bathing our body and keeping clean and keeping our clothes clean and so forth. But we're not doing it in this kind of fanatic way that is divisive or an impediment between ourselves and others, or cultivating an attitude of superiority. And so therefore, like, it's quite radical where the Buddha here is advising or is pointing out that the Arahants have abandoned all good behavior and observances, whereas most other religious groups and teachings will emphasize the hell out of this, that their good behavior and their observances are the genuine observances. And it's an impediment. It's a great impediment, actually. And particularly, I wouldn't say particularly, but I mean, certainly within the Indian world, this idea of purification has been something that the Brahmins really ran with. And they were the only ones who could do certain things, and even the kings had to pay for these Brahmins to do those things and these purification methods. And they have a whole thing about fire and burning things and washing things and burning things and washing things to purify them, and that by this purification one is sublimating one's defilements. But as we know, this isn't how we go about sublimating the defilements. We have to actually do that through cultivation, through bhavana, not by sila. So this is a very important point that the Buddha is making here to the devas, who are the target audience of this sutta. But I'd be very happy to hear what Mahadevo has to say about this.
Yeah, that translation is going to give still some lights in a singular translation. So I would just draw your attention to the direct sutta, Mahavyuha Sutta. Yekechi me dhitti paribhasana idameva sacchanti vivade anti. Sabbevate ninda manvana yanti atopasan sampi labanti tatta. That's a imagery Buddha is asking, that's a question. He's asking, anyone is steadfast with his own view, he says, I am the truth. This is the truth. Whatever you all are telling is inferior. Idameva saccham mogamanya. So that is the superiority. Will that kind of a thing will be degraded by people, or will that be phrased by many people? If someone is saying, I am the only truth, all the rest are wrong, when such a thing is presented, will others will look down him or phrase? The Buddha says, whether he is being praised or looked down, it's immaterial, because it is not purifying him. Not the phrase, not the blame. As far as it is not purifying, appangyetang alayang samaya duye vidha vivadanti palani brumi. Evampi diswana vivada yeta kemabhi passang avivada bhumi. Understanding others' phrase and gains, blames are immaterial, I mean, matter little than what you expect, because they are not leading for your purification. It's leading to you winning and losing kind of argument. Knowing the bad of that, knowing the consequences of this arguing, he give up arguing. Try to see the liberation, emancipation. So that indicates, Venerable's talk is more towards the restraint, silabhata paramasa, taking the wrong vows and taking the wrong views and practices. And that is how the Brahmanism spread. But when I'm listening to him, main thing was, Brahmins are talking about the social life. When you are living in the social life, bodily purification is important, mental purification is leading to Nibbana. So they are talking and thinking about the purification, and the Muslims are more concerned about the community life as well as bathing. That is how the civilization started near water and water base or water flows. But the Buddha says, yes, that is also purifying, but it's a physical. But the mental thing is, basic thing is you have to get rid of family life, get rid of the social life. That's a very radical. We keep that out and try to find the peace and the purity in the society. Society is a filthy. It's a hell. No purity. Whether they praise you or blame, doesn't matter, because you are weak. That is why you are going to the society. If you have enough courage, you can live as well as live in the society. Not always in the society, not always in the cave or in the forest. So therefore, you have to understand, we have to go on Pindapatha and depend on these people. They are having so much of tension and family life and responsibilities, but still they give something to eat. They give you robes. They give you dwellings. And you are respectful for them. But it's very limited. Only morning hours. Evening, as far as you are in solitude, whether you have a bath or not, it doesn't matter. Because your person, your thing is not in the community. Today, whole capitalism is making urbanization. They are discouraging in the village life. And make a hell. When there is no gas, when there is no power, when there is no water, and that becomes such a battery system for the trolley chicken. And that is very common. But still, if you live in the forest, I mean, having the relationship with the village and the going and there, you can have your own this thing. That does not indicate emancipation, that does not indicate purification, that does not indicate mental and physical. But that is a must. That's an atmosphere whereby your living is immaterial to the nature. Your living is immaterial to the society. You are just a citizen John. You are just a grain of sand on the sand bed. You are not a big shot. To make a big shot only saying, I am the only truth, you are inferior. So that kind of a thing, that is what I call civilization. Each and every civilization says, we are on the center of the earth. Chinese says, this is the center of the earth. New Zealand map, they put, New Zealand is the center of the earth. And Japanese Nazis, they say, the center of the earth. UK says, our regime is always have the sunlight. Iranobasi Nadiraja, we are the center. Bullshit. Utter bullshit. So Buddha climbing down from the palace, he went to the forest and he disappeared. He was unorganized. Was it a single one-man army or just a wayfaring elephant or a lion? No lions can live in one cave. Therefore, he is the only person made the lion society. Present-day lion society is a society. It's a bullshit. Lions are not in a society. They are living alone. Today, lions, I feel so sorry. So, taking from that, the purification, it matters. I mean, bodily purification matters. I'm very happy about the present day pharmaceutical industry because ladies are not smelling bad. Good, I thank. Leave aside your beautification. At least they are washing yourself. Otherwise, 10, 15 girls and boys living together, it's so smelly. I go to the purification rehabilitation camps in the drug addicts, utterly smelly. And one monk is telling, I keep Damaju Hamduru, all the boys very clean. They are rehabilitation, you go. I feel, Bande, this is the only place I found. Very neat and very fresh air. No, I am very concerned. When the people live together, it's utterly smelly, fishy. Fishy. So go. Under a tree or this thing. Of course, I am also in the each weekend, I am going to the town. Yes. I know the difference. So therefore, first and foremost, you have to understand for the purification of the mind, the atmosphere is very important. The theater, before the brain operation, the theater must be pure. Doctors must be pure. Equipments must be pure. Clothes must be pure. The patient must be pure. I mean physical. That we lost in Ayurveda. And Ayurveda is not competitive. For the Western medicine, that part is appreciable. But ultimately, they create diseases. That is different issue, Leblanc theory. Don't smile, American. They are the people make big labs and making the viruses. Just like neutron bombs. But when you are living in the forest and if you are reading the news articles, you can see people make such a mess. Out of this complicated and community living, Kuleya and Ganeya in Pali, we are getting away from the Kuleya and Ganeya. That means whenever necessary, we can go to our room and we can go to our cave and we can do our sitting and walking meditation. Whenever necessary, we take the ball and go to the village or go to the down there and have our share. So therefore, this is not pure theoretical or philosophizing. That Silabhata Paramasa means you must understand the cost of community living. It's utterly a cancer. I would say the infrastructure, communication facilities, IT technologies always attract you to the community living. It's a cancer. Present-day children have no way out. That's why we want to take them to and jump into the river and have play and all the kind of thing away from this the tube of illusion. So therefore, that part, we are lucky. We can have a few hours by ourselves and we can get together and have a discussion. We can read 2,600 years old books and we can have access to any kind of thing through the computers. And so you must know how to balance it, but understand the purification, it matters. The atmosphere, the renunciation. And that is very important in Silabhata. And worldly people says we are mad. That is why we are renouncing and we are going to the forest. Why can't you live and meditate in Colombo 7? If you are really a meditator, come and meditate. I said, yes, we are very weak, I'm sorry. Ta-ta, bye-bye, we go there. So that renunciation I did in my 36th year, It is not an accidental thing, highly contemplative thing. And luckily I selected this place. When I come, I found few people, they have the same idea. But many are not, even in this place. Today, more monks, more difficult, more ruining. But each and everyone knows one's own the solitude, one's own this thing. Still, they have to abide by the rules and regulations, so we are doing. And therefore, the physical and mental purification can happen. But still, we can't make a regimentation. We can't make the steamrolling. We have to say that according to the way you have entangled, you have to disentanglement happen. But please make mind clear, or mind, I mean spacious, mind space, and for that the bodily cleanliness is important. That's a kind of a respect to the society. It's called sabha gauravaya. Sabha gauravaya means that when you are in the society, you have to have the table manners. That are the etiquettes. That are respect, but hate it. Give up the etiquettes, give up the society, mind your own business. These are the viewpoints I just wanted to present, sir.
Navasarai Bhante, thank you everyone who has given comments so far. And you know, it's interesting, we were talking about sila and these practices, you know, these ritualistic practices that the Brahmins were doing during the Buddha's time. I believe that there's this sutta, I can't remember which Nikaya it's from, but the Buddha comes up to some, I guess it was Brahmins, you know, they were bathing, I think it was in the Ganges, I can't remember if it was the Ganges, but they were bathing in there, and they were saying that this is going to, like, purify me and, like, wash away all of my bad deeds. And the Buddha says, no, it's, you know, you have to cultivate your mind, and that's what washes away your bad deeds. Is, you know, you, as I was saying last week, your actions speak louder than your words. It's similar to this in the sense that, you know, the Brahmins, you know, washing or bathing themselves in the river, they believed that just by bathing myself, I'm going to, you know, wash away all of my impurities. And the Buddha said, no, you know, to them, no, like your impurities are in your mind. That's where the impurities really are. You got to tame your mind to get rid of those impurities, not just wash yourself in a river. And, growing up, I was a Christian growing up. My family is Christian. Some of them are Catholics. Some of them are other kinds of Christians, like Protestants. And, you know, my dad is certainly a Protestant. And I believe it was him I asked this question to, or this subject kind of came up, you know, on, I guess, more than one occasion when I was growing up, is, you know, the difference between Catholics and Protestants. And my dad, from what I remember, the answer that always came to being was, well, the Catholics, you know, they believe in, you know, they believe that your deeds will send you to heaven, and the Protestants believe that your faith will send you to heaven. So
please reveal that. What's the difference between baptism and the Catholics?
I'm sorry.
What's the difference to two sects?
Others. Oh! The answer that came into being in these discussions with my dad was that the Catholics believe that your deeds will send you to heaven. Essentially, your deeds, like, you know, give money to the church, you know, do good deeds, you know, be moral. Whereas the Protestants believe that your faith alone will send you to heaven. So,
Protestant day, what is the difference between Catholic says deeds are leading to your heaven?
Heaven, and Protestants believe that your faith will send you. Your faith in, you know, their God, you know, your faith in Jesus Christ, quote unquote, will send you to heaven. And I guess this is something, the reason that I bring this up is because, you know, later on when I was, I think it was probably, or it was later on, either before or after I got into the Buddhist teachings, I was thinking about this, or I have thought about this before, is, you know, your faith alone, again, you know, you could say, you'll see people in the world, you know, they'll do these bad actions, maybe they'll kill somebody, or they'll steal something from someone else, but they'll just say like, oh, I'm forgiven, you know, because I have faith in Jesus Christ or something like that. I'm forgiven. And that was the issue, the conflict. My dad is a Protestant again, and that was the issue.
Protestant and baptism equal.
I'm sorry.
Protestants and Baptists.
Baptists are Protestants. Yeah.
Yeah, they're equal.
They're the same thing. Baptists are Protestants. Yes.
Is it one part?
They're one part. They're one sect, you could say, of Protestants. But that was the issue that personally came up for me, was this idea that your faith alone can save you, essentially. And that's one of the things that I like about the Buddhist teachings, is that there's a lot of emphasis on personal responsibility. And the beautiful thing about it, though, at the same time, even though we do have sila and we do have these precepts, is that the Buddha is essentially saying that we are totally in control of our own lives and our own happiness. So there is no external source, essentially, controlling how we live our lives, whether we're happy or not. There's no, like, you know, deity or higher power that's telling us, you know, like, you're not allowed to be happy. Okay, now you're allowed to be happy. Now you're allowed to do the right things. Oh, you know, I did the wrong things because of some, you know, a demonic being. That's why I did this bad thing. No, what the Buddha is saying is that we are totally in control of our own lives and our own happiness. So if I do the right thing, that's you know, that was my choice. If I do the wrong thing, that was my choice. And I can do the right things. I have a choice to do the right things. You know, I have freedom to choose how I live my life, essentially. There's no one controlling my life and my happiness except me. And that is, I think, the beautiful thing about the Buddha's teachings and the emphasis on sila, you know, the precepts, is in a sense that, you know, again, what the Buddha was trying to teach us is that we are totally in control of our own lives and our own happiness. So, but I would say that some monks, you know, who choose to do the more ascetic practices, you know, some of them, I'm sure a lot of them are doing it to further give up attachment, you know, like maybe wearing rags instead of robes, or maybe eating, you know, less, you know, per day. They're probably just doing it to further give up attachment, whereas that might not work for every monk, you know, or every practitioner. Some monks, you know, they might feel that they can't eat, you know, they can't eat only once a day. They may need to eat more, you know, and that's fine. You know, some monks, they may feel that they would like to only eat once a day, and they can do that. Then, you know, that's great too. Some monks, you know, observe these ascetic Dutanga practices because they're trying to further give up their attachment. And they're trying to further renounce and further live simply. But I would agree that that's not going to work for everybody. Some people, and it's the same with maybe living in a community, like you see in the Thai forest tradition a lot. There's much more emphasis on community life overall. And some people, you know, may feel that that's a better option for them, whereas some people like to live in seclusion. They like to live alone, you know. And so it's just, you know, people are different. I think Bhante over here, I think he mentioned that, you know, people are different. Everyone is different. So just wanted to add to that. So that's my comment.
But Buddha never says that you have total control about the happiness and the sorrow. No. You have no full control about your life. If it is so, it will become like soul. Soul, you have a soul, you can be happy, you can be not happy. You have certain amount of willpower, but it is not total. I'm arguing with you. So you have taken Buddhism on faith, wrong faith.
I don't know if I'm trying to say that, like, wrong faith.
It's a choiceless awareness in Buddhism, in mindfulness, not the choice. You have no choice.
This is going to take some time to process.
But anyway, therefore, we can't make bold statements like that. We have control about the happiness, and then everyone will be happy. bloody fellow, they don't know. And the other thing is you have no
that's
power.
Yeah.
But after a long time, you may learn, the day you learn, there is no self. Yeah. You'll be winning, but there's no winner. So that is a complicated process.
I think we're trying to say the same thing, maybe just in two different
ways. No, completely wrong thing. I'm arguing with you.
What you're trying to say is that we have responsibility over our actions.
Yeah.
In principles, you don't have so much of controlling power. That is why the restraint is important. And you have to learn and soul, sila, samadhi, panya. Then you lose your egotistic idea. So much so, you find easy to go with the nature. Rather than changing the nature, changing yourself, all these things are views. So your views are changing. So we have to change Americans.
Okay, can I say what I think
Sumana is saying? Yeah. So he's here. Why you are going to become the lawyer for Sumana? Sumana is in accused.
You have to talk about yourself.
But you are telling.
I can say that Sumana is having.
Don't use the term Sumana. No, you have no reference to other person. He is present.
What I hear when I hear this is.
Okay.
I'm sorry for the distraction.
What one verse from the Dhammapada that comes to mind that I think might have been kind of the principle in reference to was basically the whole attavagga, which is saying that we are responsible for our own purity, we are responsible for our own impurity.
Attanameva patamam patijagge yenivare.
Or attana
sudanteena katacha akatancha.
Or sundhiya sundhi pachatang nanyo anyo visode. So basically no one else can actually do this for us, which is true. But to say that it is coming completely from this self that is kind of made up and choosing and doing everything is also not true.
No, there is no almighty God. There is no second person is there. That does not indicate you have 100%.
Yes.
So these are the two extremes we must avoid.
Yes, and one simile that comes to mind for me is the simile of the raft, for example, where we do have to kind of put together the pieces of the path to take us across to the further shore.
But,
yes, but even then we have to let that go at the end. So maybe that brings a bit of clarity.
That is sumedha, not sumana.
Thank you, Bhante.
Another American. You are two sumana or two sumedha.
Sorry, Swaminansa. Well, the one thing that came to mind was that, well, I can see how all the observances can't, and, you know, precepts can't really help us to purify ourselves or to do things out of purity. And I noticed that when I first started practicing was that when I started meditating is that I could see my actions that I wasn't realizing previously. So I think we can't see our defilements until we actually practice meditation. We can actually, then we start to see ourselves rather than seeing externalizing ourselves upon the world. We tend to, if I'm a very desirous person, then I'll be seeking desire everywhere, trying to, get other people to fulfill my desires and trying to get things in the world arranged so that my desire is fulfilled. And that's really deeply ingrained in us from childhood. So it's very, very, very hard to see that and to understand that even with precepts, you know, having precepts or observances that promote one to become selfless and, you know, more considerate of others. Even with those sort of precepts, somebody who's very desirous will still tend to be seeking desire, and that for that reason they're full of defilement and unable to see it. Even, you know, even if somebody points it out to them, they won't be able to understand really, unless they meditate, and then they're rather than looking out at the world and pointing out and trying to find ways to fulfill their desire, they'll be able to see their desire and understand. And then the community also helps them, because, you know, people have been telling you, you know, you're very desirous and you're very greedy and you're causing us a lot of pain, you know. And, you know, then the person that can actually see when they meditate, they can say, oh, yeah, now I see, because I can see my mind. And so I think that was the main thing I wanted to.
No, even if you are desirous, even if you see, very difficult for you to accept it. That is the difficulty. That is what the friends and others have to, don't push you, just let you know, because the facts are there, the consequences are there. Still the mind is not happy, because mind is desirous one. So you must have a choiceless awareness. Due to the meditation, I know. I can see consequences. That he also telling. So after that, we have to give a little time. And then only one day you will accept it. That is not your gain. It's a community gain. Whole community is responsible. That is a very expensive the atmosphere. Are you know? Are you again? That one, I am here. No, then I am here.
Avasarai Bhante, and as well, Adi Bhante is also. I like to say that we see the world, people and things through the glasses that we have put on ourselves since our childhood, due the cultural morality, and the advices our elders, teachers, and society. But through the understanding experience of the body that comes from the meditation, those mirrors can be solved one by one, and from the dreams that can be obtained by the body itself as well. That's my idea.
That is what you call Arya Pariyeshana. You put into yourself and see what are the consequences. Not just believing what book says anything, you also put in yourself. That is the becoming, that is the meaning, mean idea of becoming a monk. Yes. Better than that. Maybe better is gone. Put a hug again. No, sometimes it works because batteries are losing. You can speak louder.
Okay. My name is Axel. I'm from Norway.
Norway?
You said before.
Yeah, that's what I can't remember. That I know that he knows Chandratanam Dhruv and everything. Good. The abandoning indicates some kind of a hate. That pahana is just give up. So something, you abandon your wife, abandon your property, means that kind of a getting rid of kind of thing. So therefore translation, you have to give number of words. The getting rid of pahana, the abandoning or losing or renouncing. So therefore shades of meanings. Very difficult for when you are translating with the one word to one word translation. But you are by reading Sanskrit version and the Burmese version and the Sinhalese version, you may get. So therefore it is not the pahana when you are developing. When the reptile is growing, the outer skin is shedding. It is not abandoning. That's a shedding off the old skin. That's a particular sutta. And Uraga Sutta and Sutta Nipata, the very book we are reading. And Venerable Jnanaponika gave a very nice explanation about that. And in Nivanivimadesana also, Venerable Jnanananda quoted it often because it says that it is not you have to struggle When the maturity happens, outer skin is dropping. But don't try to have keep a piece of it as a valuable thing. It's shedding. So when the onion is growing, the outer layer is shedding. And inner layers are growing, like a banana tree or apical meristem of the trees. They are growing by cutting off. So that is always happening. But thing is, we leave, we take something as monument, so something as my favorite thing. So whole process is disturbed. So therefore, pahana and then parichanna, let's call patinisagi, pakkandana parichaga. You penetrate into that. By penetrating, you let others loose. Otherwise, you can't penetrate. As you penetrate, you have to, I mean, you are swimming, you have to push the water current around you. Then only you can go in forward. So you have to push the water. It is not against water. It is not something wrong with the water. It is not angry with the water. To get the maneuvering power, the pivotal power, to push it. So it's called pakkhandana, is plunging. Parichaga means you have to give up others. So when the birds are flying, and the aeroplane is moving, is trust by pushing the other thing around. So that is understood, thesis, antithesis, and synthesis, even in physics, even the Karl Marx, even the Buddha. Everyone is telling like that. If you wish to go, you have to push thing, and then only you can have a arrowhead kind of a push, rowing.
Thank you very much, Pante, for the good simile. That helps to understand the sutta a lot more.
Good.
Vasarai Pante, thank you everyone who has given a comment so far. Do hope that I wasn't saying that sila is the whole path. I mean, it is a central part of the path, but it's not the whole path. Meditation is actually, bhavana is actually a major, major aspect of the path too. So it all kind of builds upon each other, sila and bhavana. I was just trying to throw out there the points that, growing up, you know, in a Christian household, a Christian family, you know, especially with the Protestants, you know, like they believe that your faith alone will send you to heaven again. Like no such emphasis. They were kind of breakaway from the Catholics. They thought the Catholics were like kind of corrupt or something like that. So I guess their ideology kind of switched with that break as well, from your deeds, you know, send you to heaven, to your faith alone will send you to heaven. So I just brought it up because, you know, again, it just, you know, like even with my own father, you know, I love him very much. But, you know, sometimes when, you know, I was growing up, he would do some things that, you know, I think a lot of people would agree are not the correct thing to do. Again, you know, if your faith alone sends you to heaven, no need to, you know, take any responsibility, no need to switch, you know, how you're doing things or change your ways. No need to do any of that if your faith alone is going to send you to heaven. So all you have to do is keep believing, you know. So that's the only reason I brought that up, is because that's one of the core aspects that I like about the Buddhist teachings, with the sila and the bhavana too, is this idea that I'm taking responsibility for my own life and my own happiness. And nobody is ultimately responsible. If I do something like, I go steal something from a store, then I'm responsible for that. My faith alone is my faith in the Buddha alone is not going to change what I did. You know, it's not going to change what I did. Only, if I go jump into the Potomac River, which is near DC, that's a famous river. If I go jump in there and start washing myself in the Potomac River, that's not going to change the fact that I stole something, you know? So I have to take responsibility for my actions, you know, that's where the sila comes in. And then of course the bhavana too helps, with developing the mind. And, you know, it's really, you could say, on the psychological side of why we do bad things when we're talking about bhavana. Like, why do I want to steal something? Well, I have sensuous craving or desire. That's why I want to steal something. So the bhavana helps us to develop our minds in a way where we can begin to see the root cause of our actions, essentially, where it's coming from. Like, why do we do these things? Why do I have this desire to, why did I smash that little ant? Why did I stomp on that little ant? Well, I had some desire in my mind. You know, I must have felt that I would have gotten something out of that that would have pleased me. So, you know, why did I commit adultery or, you know, go behind my spouse's back with someone else? Sensuous craving, you know, that's why. I wanted something. So the bhavana definitely and the sila, they play on each other. And the sila can help to develop the mindfulness, and the mindfulness can help to develop the sila. And it kind of builds upon each other, as I've said before. But that's
thank
my comment.
Thank you very much for your explanation. And how do you call? Otherwise, you would have sentenced to death. I was about to accuse you and sentence to death, but that explained. But the sila bhavana, you can take it under the sila sikha, samadhi sikha, panya sikha, all sikha. What do you mean by sila? Sila sikha is something pertaining to the body and mind. Samadhi sikha is temporary arrangement of your mind. And the panya sikha is permanent arrangement of your mind. So therefore, all are sikhas. And therefore, sila is only, or sambhavana is only, means that you have not understood it under the terminology of sikha, restraint. So therefore, when you go to the nirodha saccha, in the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta or in the Satipatthana Sutta, the Buddha says, chago patinissaggo mutti analayo. That whether it is kāmatanna, bhavatanna, vibhavatanna, do you understand kāmatanna is sensuous desire? Bhavatanna is our family and everything, and everywhere we must have the happiness. But if one is, you know, is obstructing us, we have to kill him. That kind of a tanna. And to get rid of, you must have the chāga patinissaga muttya. It is dāna. Dāna also explains the same four terms. And Nirodha Saccha also explains the same four terms. Therefore, dana also very important for the sila. And sila is very important for samadhi. And samadhi is very important for the panya. And the panya again come back and facilitate dana. And dana again come and facilitate Christianity. Deeds. And then samadhi. Panya. So it is one circle, one linear system you can't put into. Many Buddhists, he tried to explain, many Buddhists take them as the purification method. They take very stern about the austere practices. Austere practices must be covered by Sammaditti Sammasankappa. Correct view and the correct mentality. Then only Samma Vacha, Samma Kammanta, Samma Ajiva, what you call sila, can happen. But the panya also a restraint. Sila also a restraint. So therefore, why should we restrain? We have the freedom, and why can't we jump and fly? That is what the science, that is what the technology, that's why the infrastructure. Don't worry about the faith, don't worry about the deed. Purchase this and you get everything. If you get a cell phone, only the toiletries are not there. Everything is in the cell phone. You need no any faith, you need no any restraint. And what happens now? Mothers and fathers coming and say, I mean, they are the people brought that bloody shit into the house. Now children gone. No sila, nothing. And the mother go and take the cell phone back or the tab. She's asking, are you my mother? I am going to kill you. Because this cell phone is much more important than you. They break cupboards. Take the cell phone. Because it is go beyond faith, it go beyond sila and everything. And people just wanted to have, not to have restraint. So Buddha says, let them have in the village, but mind your own business and go to the forest. And if you are doing, but don't make a fuss inside the house, inside the household, and have your own fun. That is called ajivaka. That is called samana. That is called monks. So they have nothing to talk with this purification of the society. Today, all the social science completely wrong. They are talking about the purification of the society. It is like a purifier, going to purify a bullshit. Whatever the way you are going to wash, bullshit it, bullshit. The Buddha says, Kinte jatai dhummeda, kinte ajinasati, abbantaran te gahanam, bairam parimajyasi. They go and have a big turban and the long, how do you call? Thread. Not only the thread, pebbles and kind of a japa mala, the mala, and the, what do you call, rosette. And cleaning all the time with the subhu vibhuti and turmeric and kind of, but inside, abhantaran te gahana, it's full of to mesmerizing females and giving om. People are very happy. But internally, what happened to that person? Few days time, man disappears. So that balance, that I am not concerned about the social purification. The American policies may would have taken. Or Sri Lankan government would have taken that policy. Because these bullshit, they don't, I can't purify myself. So they take the big contract of social purification. That is called reasoning in adult psychology. So instead, mind your own business and try to be at least one split second in this midst of all the social corruption. Even if you take 1 second, even one breath, even one step, pure. It is whole samsaric defilements cut in 1 second, chopped. It's called moha patala. Moha patala means samsaric, all the cataract in the eyes. Cut in 1 second, 2 seconds, 3 seconds. So it's such a revolutionary. Maybe the body is smelly, never mind. You can do it. So otherwise, if you don't going to give an explanation for your bad statement, I am going to give a capital punishment. So I can really, I am telling, but the way you explain your father's belief and the household belief, how a person like you to renounce it and come to Buddhism, because I am born in separate society and I admire it. Is this such a trivial thing enough for you to renounce? It may be trivial to me, but it may be very grave for you. But now I am also learning that our renunciation is happened within. And that is the most important than bhavana. Because in the bhavana also we are renouncing. But the main chunk we have given up. Always be happy, throw a party.
You know, I, again, coming back to what one of the verses we dealt with, if he has fallen away from good behavior and observances, he trembles because he has failed in his action and he longs and yearns for purity here like one on a journey who has lost his caravan. Like, again, it's pointing out to how our sila brings us together with other people. Like, it's how we can be part of the caravan. And when we give up that sila, those external practices, we lose our identity. He trembles because he has failed in his action. So there's so much identification given to these, you can call it sila, like, but it can be all kinds of ways that we become part of the club, be part of the society. You sing the certain song, you went to a certain school. You know, so therefore you're pure. Therefore you're in the in club, and if you step outside of that, you abandon that club. Then you feel naked. I mean, it's a very primal thing, to when we were born in a village in ancient times, you were born in a village or a clan or a house. Then if you got pushed out of that house, if you didn't comply with the rules and the regulations of that house or that village, then you were outcast. and this was a great loss. You would probably not survive. So shame is this emotion that like that you need to fit in. You need to share an identity, be part of the caravan, as he says here. So it's a very powerful thing. Like these rituals are very powerful. This, you know, sila is very important. But, you know, ultimately the arahant doesn't have anything to hide behind. So if we're not hiding behind these rituals, you know, we're after that truth, that deep inner truth, then these rituals become like false. Or not true. I mean, there's useful things. Like, I'm not asking you to be totally radical and you throw everything away, but you have to approach it new and take what's useful, what's supportive to the holy life, and you know, not worry about the rest. And you have to take care of this shame. Very, very careful of that, because when you go somewhere and somebody criticizes you, look at how you're dressed, and look at this isn't appropriate, and so on. You need to be able to not overcome this trembling. So like the arahant is fearless, like in a good sense of the word, fearless, like because he's good with himself. He knows the real truth. He knows what's superficial and what's useful practice and not useful practice. And he puts aside all of that. And he, you know, a big argument in this Sutta Nipata is don't argue with the fools. They don't know. So you just have to kind of quietly move on.
So skin is necessary before it becomes a shed off. After shedding off, you have to shed off. And then another skin will come. So likewise, the next skin don't consider as already shed. That's why he wanted to tell. And you have to use the utility value. After utility, you shed off. And again, another will come. And you are evolved. Bodily and mentally, you will be purified. And you can feel it. It's immediately you can feel it. Not only having a skin or getting rid of skin is natural. It's a normal. You have to understand whenever the skin is protecting, you use it. And after that, it is shedding off and it is ruining, worn out, gone. But now we have a permanent name, permanent bank account, permanent wife, permanent house, permanent... What the hell? What the hell? So after becoming a monk, you are a new name, new person, new culture, new language, new food. Thank you very much for the participation. And I'm happy that coming from multivarious cultures and kind of thing. And luckily, good participation, good presentation of your own views. That means we are trusting each other. Thank you very much.